Good morning and welcome back. 434-1790. I got one suggestion coming from a former student of mine who is now Dr. Ronnie Yearwood, based on the UK solution where persons are often paid more if they come from a farther distance. I'm familiar with this system because I appreciate that a person who works in Barbados, I live in Barbados, and the vast majority of my clients do not reside in Barbados. They don't really have any clients in Barbados. And in many instances in places like Trinidad and Tobago, for example, you can get my services a lot cheaper from someone locally because that person doesn't have to come from so far. And of course, you pay to bring me a farther distance. So I think that for persons like Dr. Yearwood and myself, it's easier to negotiate that kind of arrangement because you're talking about a higher level service where a person is prepared to pay for quality. So they say, I want you and I will pay whatever it costs to get you to the place of work. If it's a little bit more, I'm willing to pay that. The challenge is that it doesn't work at levels when you're talking about someone who is working as a maid or a butler or a bartender or someone like that. No, let's be clear. I'm not trying to decry anyone's profession, but I'm saying that where you are doing a service that is relatively easy to replicate, the argument might be to that person as the employer, why should I be forced to pay someone who lives in Josie Hill an allowance to allow that person to get to work when I can get the same service from someone who lives just down the road? So when you're talking about clerical positions, when you're talking about persons who work cooking food and things like that, it becomes a problem, and that's the reason why, and I understand it, Tom Adams came up with this 25-cent flat rate across the board, because it really was a disincentive to persons who live far. Down to Brass Tacks, good morning.
A very good morning to you, Peter. Good
morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. Thanks for yourself.
I'm great.
Good.
Now, Peter, I'm blessed.
Yeah, that's good. Peter, what I want to say to you is that it can't be as business as usual if you want a bare boat change. And when I'm saying that, I'm endorsing lots of what you're saying. But when we get now to the point of government buildings, until government put a good maintenance plan in place for its buildings and for transport, we will always be in the same pathway. Mm-hmm. And that's where it starts. You have to, in some way, decide to get things up and running where you can revamp some of these derelict buildings, and it's not hard. You have to look at areas of maintenance. You don't need a ministry for it. You need to have a very good understanding as to what you want and to go about it. Mm-hmm. It's going to cut your costs in areas of rentals. Because it don't make sense if you have a building laying down that you can revamp. But when you do your financial study, you're paying out sums of monies to somebody else to rent their building. Point in case, you have Black Rock. You've just revamped the Black Rock police station. Why is it taking so long to get the police, put the workers back in there? But they're still at a point, I think, paying rentals for another building. So you got to get really serious if you really want a brand new change. Transport. I said it before. We have outlets where you're doing repairs to vehicles. Why can't you, in some way, saying that you're the owner of a lot of land in this country, which is the government, have 10 acres and have an equipped workshop set up, and each and every government vehicle goes there with an LPO. I can't understand why things are so hard or so difficult to get done.
Will you go there with an LPO for what, for maintenance?
Yeah, the local purchase always written up from ministry. I have to sell one of the vans because I have a broken differential. The one from education. You look, drive around this country, you see a bunch of vehicles that are just laying down.
No, but I'm trying to understand, why can you not have private contractors that are responsible for servicing the Ministry of Health vehicles, private contractors responsible for servicing the Ministry of Education vehicles. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that, Violin.
Because my sense is that people feel the only way you can do this is if government does it itself. And I'm saying that
I think
a far better solution is to have a maintenance contract. If you buy a vehicle, you need to have a maintenance contract either with the garage or alternatively with a private person. And I think the idea of a private person helps to create employment, where when something breaks down on the vehicle, they can go to that. The Barbados Police Force has mechanics. And I've often wondered why they don't have a private system where you can have, because it doesn't seem to work very efficiently, because police cars don't seem to have a very long lifespan. I guess because they get roughed up more than other vehicles. But why can you not have a contractual arrangement with private, you know, providers to be able to service these vehicles and keep them on the road? All right. See, sir, the golden part of what you're saying is that government needs to have a maintenance plan and not just buy things. So roads, for example, there needs to be a maintenance plan. You build Highway 2A, every 10 years, it has to be resurfaced. So my thing is that everything that you do, you build in a maintenance plan as part of your recurring budgetary expenditure.
Fair enough.
When Victor Cook was at the university, Victor Cook always used to say, you can't just create a post and look at funding in the short term. When you create a post, you have to assume that that post will cost you 10% more in the first 3 years, and you go on in that way. And it's the same argument. So my thing is, if you have a building and you create the funding for the building, you also have to create the long-term funding for the maintenance of that building, which can be done with a private contractor. And sir, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. What I am not agreeing with is this idea of bringing everything together under one thing and everybody comes to some acre of land and basically say every car that needs fixing come there. No, because then there's another government ministry and government mess that you're creating.
All right, good. Point taken. But let me explain to you now your site. While I would endorse your site, I would then want to see good transparency. And I know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to give the private contractors, I don't have a problem with that.
Let them compete.
But let it be good transparency, whereby that when a vehicle goes there for a problem, it is rectified within a certain time, and the cost of it is clear. And I can explain to you off here what I'm speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
So I can endorse what you're saying once you have transparency within the system. Now, you know, for a long time, Peter, we've been going on and going on and going on with this transport system. Your guy there, he made some valid points, some good points. That just talked to you there. He made some good points. Maybe he should be a guy that you can sit down sometime with and draw from his
Remember, you remember when the bus fares went to 25 cents in one year? What was the year?
I can't remember the year. It got to be sometime in the 70s.
Because this, somebody's telling me online it wasn't Tom Adams, it was Al Barrow that standardized it.
I thought it was standardized
when the Barbados Transport Board was created, which was effectively under a BLP government.
It was something that within the transport board. After the private concessionaries, the government took over and formulated the transport board. Then that came about.
Right, and that was done when in before 76 or after 76.
I can't remember that.
Okay.
This old brain can't remember that. Now, let me explain something to you about the transport. Right, first you say that we have a transport authority that is there. But I want to tell you clearly, the transport authority needs dismantling. You understand what you're saying?
But wait.
All right, let me explain that way.
Okay, it don't work.
It don't work.
Well, right, but then what we need to do is make it work.
Ah.
Give them something to do.
No, because let me explain to you clearly, because a lot of people know my voice, hear my voice, and say, are you only talking? But let me tell you clearly what you do, the transport authority want dismantling. For the same reason that we talk about a transport set up in this country for years, the transport authority has been introduced within the last couple of years, right? But at the same time, we can't get a transport system going properly.
Well, it started.
Good.
The transport authority has been started. It's been set up. They now have nice offices. So let's hope that the next
You know right now, we're, as we speak, the position where the private permits are as we speak right now.
What is the situation?
And the guide right now say that, you had a guide early on say that there are more or less creating a havoc on certain routes. This is true. You got over 480 something that are vans on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And probably 200 going to Silver Sands.
So to be quite honest, we really don't have a transport problem. We don't have a problem with supply.
We don't have a problem with transport. We have a problem
with allocation.
Allocation.
Right. And agreed. We have an allocation problem. We don't have a transport problem.
You see?
Because with 400 units on the road, there is absolutely no way somebody who lives in Fort Royal St. John should be complaining about getting
it. No, but I tell you clearly, the French want...
Transport authority has its work to do. Don't say that we don't need a transport authority. We need to give it a job to do regarding the regulation of those routes and whatnot. But they can only do that if there's a facility whereby you can help a person who is working on one of these long routes, like the same one in Four Roads, to be able to make a dollar leaving Bridgetown and driving all the way to St. John without being able to change passengers on the road. Anyhow, we're gonna quit there. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we continue. Welcome back to Down to Brass Tacks, 434-1790. Let me make a correction here, and I want to thank both Tony Wiggins and George Griffith for sending me this information. I received a note basically reminding me that the bus fares actually came down to 25 cents in 1975. Now, I mistakenly said it was 1976, and I assumed it would have been after the change of government in 76, so it would have been a Tom Adams initiative. When Randall McLean spoke to me about it, he really would have said Arrowboro. It's just that I was getting the prime ministers mixed up. So bus fare was brought down. The highest stage fare was 65 cents, and the transport board was set up. It was brought down to 25 cents across the board in 1975 by Errol Barrow. And my understanding is that it was an initiative that Barrow was taking with regard to regaining the government in 76. It didn't work out anyhow. But nonetheless, we benefited from 25 cents bus fares from 1976. So the logic is same as I was explaining it about the disincentive. However, it was 1975, an Errol Barrow initiative to bring bus fares across the board to 25 cents from the highest stage, which was 65 cents. We would be so glad for 65 cent bus fare now if you think about it. So thanks, gentlemen, Tony, and also thanks, George, for the clarification. Down to Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, Peter.
Morning, Mom. How are you doing, dear?
Yes.
I'm great.
How are you doing?
I'm blessed.
Good.
And you are?
I got it here washing my hand. Do I have to pay $1.50 for that water? I wash my hand, right?
Yeah, you got to pay $1.50 for the month.
For the month?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that was spare. That will go over. See that? I come in. You see you? You is no use at all. See that? I get this boy. You is no use. But I love you. Peter, I got a problem.
Yes,
if you got an attorney at law, and he say he gone into the House Assembly or whatever,
mm-hmm.
his duty ain't to notify you that he will turn you over to somebody and see if he will really like to go to that person or not.
Assuming that, yeah. So what, he's no longer able to work?
Yeah, he's no longer able to
work. He's a minister.
Well, he's in the house.
No, but if he's in the house, he can still work for you.
But his duty is to write and tell you, well, look,
no.
Able to work.
Is he a minister of government?
Yes.
Oh, if he's a minister, then yeah, he can't work, right?
So the thing is about it, he should write you and say, well, look, I will turn you over to Mr. Wickham, and if you want to stay with Mr. Wickham, or you got a choice of your own.
I agree with you that would be the dignified thing to do. The problem is that most lawyers who get into politics don't really have the time, so they just turn over the files to somebody.
Don't forget that I was your client.
Right. Yeah.
So that's bad manners. That's right. Number one. Number two, I see the transport board got men and women in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see for the new term, and well, my minister, he already could tell that. And he got to look into it. They want wearing proper uniforms.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Proper uniforms. Because if they slip the police here, they can pass it down yonder. And he ain't studying that. He's studying to get off the road.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you got to them back in uniform. The van mustn't go all that lot of smoke in your face. The
inspection.
Feet walking back. You know, these are things that you got to look at. And you carrying people on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing that I'm looking at, did you run in a store lately?
Yes.
You look at the receipt.
What did the receipt say?
The receipt says that Peter buried out for X amount. And therefore, when you get one, you can't sell up on your receipt.
Well, because of fit.
I buy a set of saucepans. Mm-hmm. And the man tell me the saucepan good, they ain't going to burn. Before they done cut the rice, the thing burn.
Mm-hmm. So you have to carry it back.
They ain't want to take it back because they done got your money already. Mm-hmm. You understand? It is these things that, if you know that, you are them that ain't going to say, I will trade. You can't say that, you ain't say it will trade.
You have a fair trading commission there for things like that. If you buy something, it should be fit for purpose. If it is not fit for the purpose for which it is bought, then you certainly are entitled to a refund of your money. And the fair trading commission would help you in that regard.
But the fair trading cancel the thing for the ticket. That's what you're trying to tell you. It's fair out.
Yeah, but that too is also a fair trading issue, because if the receipt doesn't last for a reasonable time, then that also is something that should attract your attention.
Next thing I want to go into, mm-hmm. if people are reading the road, mm-hmm. you want to tell me they can't get somebody to take up the stuff the same time or the next morning.
That's a long-standing problem.
Ain't a long-standing problem.
Just weed the road and leave it, and then 3 months later, the cars come and push it back, spread it out. It's foolishness.
I'll drive over it, and then it goes down to the ground, you know. And my minister's going to work. Mm-hmm. I would just ask the public to just give them a break, settle the nerves, get a little Guinness or something and drink, settle the nerves, and it's going to work.
But if you drink Guinness, you ain't going to be settled. It's Red Bull that will settle.
All right, drink a vodka then with a little water, and it can settle. Have a good morning.
We talking about our minister of transport? I want he drinking a vodka. I want he settling. Don't drink a coffee or something on the morning. I get cracking. But I agree with you, ma'am. It's always good to hear you. And I'm so happy that these days you and I are seeing eye to eye. Or at least for now, you and I are seeing eye to eye. It's Dr. Brastocks. Good morning.
Good morning, Peter.
Yes, sir. How are you doing?
I'm fearing you.
I'm great.
All right. Now, I want to add to your discussion on the transfer of the taxes from, you know, the direct lump sum onto the petrol.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I want to make a point first about something Patrick said earlier. He said that within 3 weeks, Abrams, the minister, I think, one of the two, mm-hmm. were responsible for the clearing up of the mess on the South Coast. And he was able to do that in 3 weeks. And I don't really share that view, because I recall that after the high-level meeting, remember when Mia hit the ground running and they called the next day or so, they called a meeting and everybody went up there. One of the things that she said was that a lot of money was already spent on the project and she's leaving it just as it is for the engineers to continue doing what they were doing. That is that they would drill the 4 boreholes. And it will direct the wastage to the holes. And as soon as it was possible, they did it. And it doesn't matter who would have been there, that's what would have been done. So I think it wasn't fair to say that the minister got it done in 3 weeks, because he didn't do anything. The engineers just continued working mm-hmm. as they were before on the plan that they had. Right? No, sufficient for that. Let us look at this imposition of the taxes on the
fuel.
Fuel. Now, I like the idea. From the time I heard it, I like it. Problem for me, though, is that my license fees have doubled when I do the calculation. At first, I didn't know how much would have gone on, so I like it because of that. I figured it might be like a penny or a cent or something. So, but it has gone, and it will double. Now, it may drive me in the direction of an electric car. But nevertheless, I still agree with it. The reason why I agree with it is that I think you can do more things with it, because the intention was that those who were driving vehicles on the road, and a lot of people were driving vehicles on the road, did not pay their license, right? And some of these people were knocking you down, they were getting in accidents and different things like that. Even these motorcycle riders, some of them were all over the place, and a lot of these motorcycles don't seem to have not even a number plate. So I guess they don't have any license. But now they're all paying. Everybody is paying once you go on the road. What I was thinking, though, is that the real danger that people face these days is the problem with the insurance, in that when you get hit by a vehicle which doesn't have insurance, whether it be your vehicle being struck or a physical person being struck, you're sometimes left in a quandary. Suppose it is something where you get injured real seriously and you need, say, $100,000 or so. you're left on your own because somebody struck you. So I'm thinking, I'm wondering if a little bit extra could have gone on for insurance as well, and not just for road tax, so that everybody on the road is insured. Because everybody on the road now is not insured. Everybody on the road right now is paying taxes. It's paying the license or the license. They call it the license or the road tax. Everybody is paying road tax now through the fuel. Mm-hmm. Can we add on 5 cents more or 10 cents more to ensure that everybody is also insured as well? I know that it can have some issues with it, right? Because different people with different high-powered vehicles and lower-level vehicles, they pay a different insurance rates. But I am still thinking that you will still have your insurance, right? But if you pay this little fee, everybody is insured, and this is particularly in the case where would be useful in the case where people are injured, where they will be taken care of.
So, sir, interesting point. My default position is that what should happen in a situation like this is that the penalty for driving an uninsured vehicle should increase. And I would like the penalty to be a summary penalty, not a situation where you have to go before a magistrate and, you know, all of that nonsense. I think it should be a summary situation where if you are caught driving a vehicle without insurance, that you are liable to paying a fine on the spot. Or, well, a fine within 24 hours to some agency that is quite prohibitive. So,
but Peter, that, they're not forcing you. But listen, do you really think, right, that you, these guys that ride motorcycles without license plate, they really would even listen to that or care about that? They're still going to do what they got to do, so you're not going to discourage them?
Well, you know, my point is that then the fine has to be sufficiently prohibitive, because I don't really know that you can do, like, you're talking like an Obama situation where you are creating a penalty, a fee that right. goes towards insurance. And I don't know, right. I don't know if that type of system will work, but my idea is that you need to ensure that the guys are insured. And the best way to make them insured is to say, look, if you are uninsured and you get into a vehicle, you are liable for the damages to your car or the other person's life and so on. But you are also liable for a fairly substantial punitive penalty as a result of that. And those motorcycle guys are a law unto themselves.
Right.
But I think that for the rest of us that are relatively more rational, something like that could work, where you increase the fine. Because right now the challenge with road traffic fines is that they're so hard to collect. You have to go to court and go before a magistrate, and there's a whole long, complicated, unnecessary system that certainly needs to be simplified. And my thing is that if a policeman catches you without insurance, you should be liable to be given a ticket that says you automatically have to part with $2,000-$3,000.
But you see, sometimes people go on the road, they're civil people, and it seems to me they were on the road because of the economic situation too, and they're just taking the risk. Mm-hmm. Maybe what you say might deter that kind of person, and even so, they might still take the little risk. But some people will not be deterred, and God forbid, if someone is struck by them, there's definitely going to be no insurance coverage for them. Mm-hmm. So it's just to protect them that I was thinking.
Yeah, it's an interesting facility, and I do like the idea of, somebody's saying that driving without insurance should be a $5,000 fine and impound the car until payment is made. That type of thing could work.
If you catch the people, if you can catch
you catch them, right. Because no, if listen, they get an accident, you catch them.
Listen, we got situations here where people knock down people and run, and you don't ever catch them. So even if a fine was high, if a fee was high, fine was high, they can still do that and run away if they can. And then that person who got knocked down in trouble, right? Now, Peter, if I got time, I would like to mention one other thing, though.
Just mention it quickly, and then I'll let you go, because we don't have a lot of time. Yeah.
Oh, sure. This is one I would like to expand. But looking at productivity in the civil service, I was thinking that all people should be retired at around 45 years old, and not 75 or 76. We actually need to lower the retirement age. And the reason for that is that I think when people are retired young, they're very productive still. And a young person retired will be looking at going into doing something. Either they'll be looking at additional employment, because they may still have the children to stay in school and so, and they still have the commitments. So all along, say you're working from 20 years old to 20 to 45. You'll be planning for your early retirement. And for a lot of people, they may be thinking about entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. So they may be thinking of setting up a business and doing things like that with some of the gratuity money and so on. What happens is that when they leave the system so early, they create a job for somebody else. The young person, say, out of the UE or so, can come into the system. Meantime, because they're going to business, they automatically create employment for another 5 or 10 people, depending on the kind of business they go into.
Okay.
And that in itself would generate a lot of revenue. Now, it helps, too, because if you have someone in the system at 45 years old who is retired, they're retired, but they're still in the system till they get 76, they're not going to be productive.
Mm-hmm.
They're just retired.
Or less productive.
Pardon me?
Or less productive.
Or less productive. Yeah. So you can get them out of the system. And it doesn't even mean that you can't even return the system. You might even be able to be recycled back into the system under different conditions or maybe under contract or so on. But you can get all the people out of the system who are not productive or very low in the productivity. You can rid them out of the system, and you have less confrontations with unions and so on. No?
Okay. All right, sir, we're going to have to run because it's that time when we have to go to the regional roundup, I believe. It is now 11:54. Dennis normally takes us out around this time to make way for the regional roundup. So our conversation continues. We have about 10 minutes and then we get back to the pressing issues that we've been talking about today. Do stay with us.